Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode here at the Damage Report. It being a Tuesday, you never know who you're gonna get when it comes to co-hosts, and we've got a special treat for you. Returning once again to the show, Wazi Lambre. Wazi, how's it going?
I'm good, man. Happy to be back, of course. It's always dope to join you, John. It's fun, and you know, I know about the army over here on this side. They've done nothing but lift me up and raise me since my first appearance. And so,
nice.
You know, shouts to everybody.
That's awesome. I'm seeing your face in the Twitch chat quite a bit. I know, well, we're very glad that you're back, especially because you've been busy lately. So, what have you been up to?
Well, yesterday was my first official day at the Ringer/Spotify. I will be over there as a staff writer, as well as a very frequent podcaster on all manner of things from the NBA to pop culture, et cetera, et cetera. Extremely excited about the opportunity. Founder Bill Simmons is somebody that I've been reading and consuming his work for 20 years now. You know, This is like basically like a dream come true to be working with Bill, as well as the rest of the team over there, Mallory Rubin, Sean Fennessy, Chris Ryan, those are the homies. So I'm really excited, man, just super pumped.
That's awesome. You know, and I'm also jealous because you obviously, you know, we love having you in to talk politics, but you also get to do other things. It's always a little bit jealous. Anyway, thus, sometimes the seams split on TDR and we talk about things that have nothing to do with our actual mission statement. But anyway, in addition to all of that, you also have your show. So can you tell us a little bit about your Twitch show? And maybe we can bring up that graphic.
Well, Wozniak is just, you know, it's just a little show we put together where on Tuesday and Wednesday nights, you just hang out with me where, you know, I break down some of the current news and politics, et cetera, et cetera. On, you know, just try to keep it light, try to keep it fun, but try to, you know, give a different spin on the kind of news that's coming out on a day-to-day basis, right? There's a certain coverage you can get from the big cable news companies or the Sunday shows, but we want to do something different and alternative when it comes to covering politics in the news. And then, you know, aside from that, we get into all manner of things, you know, all manner of things, whether it be my social life here in LA, my dating life, et cetera, et cetera. We want to give dating advice. We want to do all kinds of fun things, but yeah, the main bag is always going to be talking about politics, specifically from, you know, a lefty slant.
Nice. That sounds awesome. I like that. All manner of things. That's what we need. That's tonight, 7 p.m. Pacific time, so everyone can check it out. Twitch.tv/TYT. You can see a lot of people just literally just screaming your name over and over on the Twitch chat. So that's awesome. They seem to like you. They really like you.
Shouts to the dragons.
Exactly. Thank you everybody for watching, regardless of what platform you're on. I really appreciate you being here. By the way, there was I'm not gonna say what, but there was a particular call for a particular emoji that, funnily enough, the graphics team is working on right now to my horror. But anyway, we'll talk about that a little bit later on because I have a feeling they're gonna push it out today during the show. But thank you for being here. Please hit the like button, share the stream if you haven't already. And as Wazi and I go through the news, you can send us messages, tweets, super chats, all that. And we'll respond as we go. We've got a lot that we're gonna be diving into through the course of today. A little bit of good news, both just good news, also good news coming as a result of political pressure, which is my favorite kind of good news. So we've got that on refugees, on vaccines, on paid family leave. We got a little update on what's going on in LA, actually. We don't often talk about LA specifically, but we got a bit of that today. And then Media Matters did an amazing analysis of the anti-trans coverage on Fox News. It's mind blowing, so you're not gonna wanna miss that. And if there's time, we're gonna try the media sort of just giving the right what they want on their in their campaign to annihilate voting rights. So we'll get into that near the end of the hour. So stay tuned, we'll have that for you. But why don't we jump into our first big topic, a little update on something we've been talking about throughout the year. Joe Biden, just a couple of weeks ago, was announced to be completely reversing himself on his multiple promises to re-raise the refugee cap above the effectively zero level that Donald Trump had put it at. Now, he'd promised over and over he was going to raise it, and then a little bit ago, they decided maybe not so much. And people freaked out, and they should freak out in the same way that we freaked out on things like, for instance, his desire to continue border wall construction. And they backed off of that, and thankfully it looks like they're backing off of this, with Biden putting out a statement saying, "I am revising the United States annual refugee admissions cap to 62,500 for this fiscal year. This erases the historically low number set by the previous administration of 15,000, which did not reflect America's values as a nation that welcomes and supports refugees." He says furthermore that he plans to basically double it for next year, getting it to 125,000, in line with a commitment he made in his first foreign policy address at the State Department. CNN had, as I alluded to previously, reported that Biden resisted signing off on re-raising it because of political optics. And that's how you know that one of your often stated values is core to your ideology, when all it takes is political optics to make you throw it in the trash. So anyway, they are raising it. Wazzy, what do you think?
First of all, 62,000 is unconscionable, if we're being honest, right? Specifically when you consider on the front end of some place, a place like Yemen, where we provided the Saudis with all the weapons and the support to bomb the living crap out of that place. And then on the back end, when people's lives are affected, we say, you can't come here. You know, we help make your situation what it is through our affiliations with countries that we call allies. And you know, now these people are desperate and need help, and we basically turn a cold shoulder. And then that's not even to speak of Central America, where 30 years of US policy and you know, basically coups where we overthrew democratically elected governments, installed right-wing strongmen, not to mention the war on drugs, which has turned a lot of those places into literal war zones over the drug wars and drug turfs. And then on the back end of that, we turn around and tell these people whose lives have literally been turned upside down by US foreign policy that they can't come in. And then we say 62,000 like we're freaking, you know, Mother Teresa or something.
Exactly. Yeah, and then the 62,000, once you break that down by region, becomes just a few thousand for a bunch of regions. So here's what we're not gonna do. We're not gonna do one of, I'll identify at least two forms of bias that you're gonna likely see come up around this topic. So one is gonna be, yes, Biden did it. He did it, he's the best. He's the best around. We're not gonna do that. So we have to add the context that Wazzy just did, that it's objectively not a lot, whether looked at through the lens of our current population or the level of crises internationally that are generating refugees. Oh, also historically, it's not very good, because back pre-Trump, it was at the 110 to 120 level, and nobody was like, oh my God, America's really doing good work with refugee resettlement there. We're only halfway to that. It feels like the corporate tax rate, honestly, to me. It's like the Republicans come in, and they cut it to pieces, and then we're supposed to feel amazing because it's halfway duct taped back together. But that said, I'm not gonna do the other type of bias, which is probably not even talk about this at all, because it at least kind of a little bit reflects well on Biden, also kind of reflects well on the activists and progressive politicians that pushed him to raise it. So I'm not gonna do that. I'm not gonna be like, you know, like, Trump's to the left of Biden or whatever. So we're going to be realistic. It's not always the most exciting, but that's what we're gonna do. And we're going to appreciate people like, for instance, Representative Ilhan Omar, who's been pushing for the raise in there. She seemed happy on Twitter, putting the happy like celebration face, which sort of makes sense. She herself has been a refugee. Not a lot of our representatives have, not a lot actually have firsthand information understanding what that life is like. And while I'm sure she is gonna continue to push for that number to be far more than the low level it is right now, we can acknowledge that it at least is a little bit of good news, I guess. I don't know. What other thoughts do you have, Wazzy?
Yeah, I mean, it is good news. Of course, it's better than 15,000. That's, you know, anybody can do that math. Even me, my remedial self could do that that math. But, you know, again, it's just, as you mentioned so beautifully, John, like, it was at 120,000, and nobody was And nobody was like, oh my God, we have so many resettled refugees here in America. We're doing the humanitarian aid thing so splendidly here in America. Like nobody was saying that. And that's not to kill Biden. To be honest, Biden is kind of in line with the mainstream of the Democratic Party. Their immigration policy has been incoherent for years. They basically kind of got creamed on the Dreamers thing. And you know, the Mexican people who have sort of came here when they were really young, and even the people across the aisle who were trying to get that stuff through, like people like Marco Rubio, got so creamed on it. They've done nothing but run with their tails behind in between their legs ever since, right? So it's not like Biden is being some huge departure from the party. This is kind of the party's line. It's incoherent, but you know, still, obviously, I would like to see us do more.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I just want to throw out one extra thing, and that is that so they raised the number, but like they're not going to do it this year. Like the 62,000, they're not going to get 62,000. So Biden said the sad truth is that we will not achieve 62,500 admissions this year. We are working quickly to undo the damage of the last 4 years. It will take some time, but that work is already underway. So saying it's, you know, Trump decimated the process, the system, the paper stuff, whatever. So that's the reason. He says, we might not make it the first year, but we are going to use every tool available to help these fully vetted refugees fleeing horrific conditions in their home countries. And as of, say, the end of March, only a little bit more than 2,000 refugees had been admitted to the US. So I don't know, like, again, it's good that it's going up, but like, what does it mean to raise it to 62,000 if we're not going to reach it? Because the reason they're not going to reach it isn't a lack of demand. It isn't a lack of fully vetted refugees. Those exist. So what is the reason that you're not going to do it? Like the right flights aren't taking off? What exactly is the reason? Because like we're a country with virtually unlimited resources, and you say that this is something that's going to restore the soul of America and all that. So I feel like it's fair to say, okay, so you're implying something Trump did makes that unreachable. What is that? Because you're not being specific. And if you're not being specific, then I'm wondering if you're just passing the buck. And that kind of what looks like what it is.
That's exactly what it is. And the funny thing about it is I kind of think this immigration boogeyman is kind of a bit overblown. I don't think people actually care that much about this, which is what I think the problem is. The people who do are extremely passionate, and everybody else is kind of dispassionate. So that very vocal minority of people who are just like, oh my God, refugees, you're ruining America, blah, blah, blah. We're gonna have to have freaking good food and stuff like that now. Like what the hell, who wants that? I feel like those people are so vocal and so loud, but like it's this sort of an indifference amongst everybody else, right? There's not an equal amount of people rabble rousing on the other side. I think most people are sort of passively like going through their lives, like whatever, we get more immigrants, that's cool, but can I get some money? So exactly. I think that's what it feels like with this issue, and why that very obnoxious vocal minority is kind of gets their way on this specific issue.
Yeah. No, I think that you're definitely right. And obviously you have Fox, who likes to, you know, they forgot how much they cared about this issue because they supposedly care about women's sports now. But every once in a while they'll remember. But there's not really an equivalent in even centrist media where they're like, please save the refugees. That occasionally happens, but it's not, they don't constantly go back to it.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
So we have an opportunity this week internationally for something to be done about the vaccine patents that are stopping so many countries that are currently being destroyed by the pandemic from being able to domestically manufacture vaccines. That's going to be considered. So I thought it would be a good idea for us to take stock of here in the US, who's in favor of getting rid of the patents and who's not. And more importantly, why? So why don't we start with those who are against it? Some with their silence and some sort of vocally against anything being done about these patents, anything being done to sort of balance the scales, with the scales having on one side billions in profits for a few mega corporations and the other a couple million people's lives. So there was great reporting over the HuffPost. Daniel Moran's reported late last night that 110 House Democrats have signed on to a letter calling on President Joe Biden to support India and South Africa's proposed vaccine patent waiver at the WTO, which is set to consider the idea again this week. So that's good that they are in favor of it. As The Intercept reported last week, factory owners around the globe from Bangladesh to Canada have said that they stand ready to retrofit facilities and move forward with vaccine production if given the chance. So if the patents are gotten rid of, if the information is given to them, they can begin spooling up their factories, produce the vaccine, and hopefully stop some needless suffering and death. For instance, the manager of Incepta, a pharmaceutical firm in Bangladesh, says they can do 600 million to 800 million doses per year. So we throw this out there because there's this belief, Wazi, like maybe not stated, that like what's the difference if we get rid of the patent? These countries couldn't possibly produce a liquid that goes in a vial. I feel that that's out there, and I just want to remind people, no. They already make vaccines. They can make this one and they really, really need it. But anyway, as alluded to, I will get to those who are against it. But what do you think so far?
This is just ugly. It's ugly. It's capitalism at its ugliest. Not everything needs to be a method or a mode by which you turn a buck. You know, like a global pandemic shouldn't probably be where you apply your profiteering, avaricious instincts. You should probably fall back and chill and honestly get in front of being like, you know what? We're gonna save lives. We're waving it. We're putting lives over dollars. But of course not. These are potentially hundreds of millions, if not billions, of customers. That's how the pharmaceutical companies are seeing it. So it's like, why would we give up that huge customer base when we could just rein in, you know, make it rain profits for how long, right? And it's just morally just unconscionable and disgusting. It's horrible because there's no justification for this besides just pure profit driven motive. That's it. Yeah. No, nothing else comes before that. Not human lives, not the well-being of others, not any humanitarian streak. Not that capitalistic endeavors ever really have humanitarian streaks. But again, like sometimes these big companies like to feign like they care about anything other than money. This is nasty.
Nothing but love, but I gotta admit, you're coming off like a guy that's never wanted to install a yacht elevator in your house or have some choice in yacht. I like to color coordinate my boat shoes with my yacht, and I'm not gonna get to that by caring about whether a couple of million people, Brazil and India, die, okay? But no, obviously, I agree with you. I understand that this story is both objectively complex. I think, and also we need to understand there's a lot that, you know, I'm not an expert in this. I don't understand. I think a simple solution that I talked about on the show yesterday, which is we take like $1 to $2 trillion and we just buy doses and give them freely to the rest of the world. I know it seems crazy, the idea that America would spend even one of its cents on saving people's lives, but considering all the damage we've done, which you've talked about previously, seems like a good idea. That's clearly not gonna happen. Tucker Carlson's face would explode on camera, which is a nice side effect. But anyway, so we're not gonna do that. Maybe we can get rid of the patents. But while we talked about that letter with the 110 House Democrats that have signed on to it, which by the way is like less than half of the caucus, so not a good look for half of them. Why aren't more people on there? Well, as Daniel Moran's of HuffPost, again going to his reporting, noted, none of the 9 House Democrats among Congress's top 25 recipients of donations from pharmaceutical industry PACs have signed the letter, which is like the weirdest coincidence. That's so weird. None of them, none of the 9. And by the way, for you Tolkien fans, I love that the people most evil in this story are the 9. But anyway, Democratic reps Scott Peters and Ron Kind, they're number 7 and 19, by the way, on the top 25 list, have actually solicited support for another letter to Biden asking him to not waive the intellectual property rules. No word yet on if the letter will actually be written in the blood of international peasants who will die thanks to their advocacy for pharmaceutical funds. But anyway, so look, they're not signing on to it. They may have their own letter, and there's, for every one of those 9, there's more than 10 others who are just not saying anything. They just really don't have any opinion on this. And when you think about how many lives are at stake, and by the way, let's say that you didn't care about lives. We always have to consider that our country and the world is filled with sociopaths. How do you expect the international economy to function if some of the largest countries in the world are continually racked by COVID for the next 5 years? And then when you create this massive breeding ground for further mutated strains of the virus, I'm sure that'll never come back to the US. I don't know, Wazi, it just seems, in every way you can conceive, it seems short-sighted, cruel, arguably evil.
But it's the system, right? This is textbook corruption. This is textbook, by the book, definitional corruption. Yes, our campaign finance laws is such that it's legal for pharmaceutical companies to lobby certain politicians and get their agenda through at the expense of literally everybody else. Like, and I mean like everybody, you know?
Yeah.
Like that this small group of people can have, you know, sort of their will exerted upon the government is just kind of crazy, but this is what it is. And you know, a lot of times we do a lot of moralizing about the Dems and the Republicans and et cetera, et cetera. But the system is such that, man, if I don't care whether you have a D or R in front of your name, if people are paying for you to keep you in power, you're gonna do their bidding. I don't care who you are. I don't care how principled you are fundamentally. I don't care how, like, you know, idealistic you might be. Whoever's signing them checks is who you're gonna support. And that's what we're seeing from these Democratic congressmen. Like, it's obvious that they've been bought and paid for by the big pharmaceutical companies.
Clearly.
To the point where they're willing to put their names on this. This is insane to me.
Well, look, I think you're 100% right. I think that these congresspeople have been bought off. They've been paid, I don't know exactly how much, but apparently enough for these people to quietly, patiently watch as tons and tons and tons of people needlessly die. I guess it's good money. I don't know, I've never really had access to it. What you're supposed to have in this case then is a leader of the party who will beat them over the head with whatever is necessary to get them to fall in line. President is supposed to be the leader of the party, is he the leader of the party? Because we're gonna transition now to our next topic. Heads up in advance, we're about to show you arguably the longest continual video. We never play videos this long, but the reason we're doing it is I could not cut it. I just couldn't cut it. So we're gonna just prep yourself, it's worth it, as we launch into our next story. So when the WTO is debating this week the possibility of doing something about vaccine patents and potentially waiving them, one leader could be, in this topic, Joe Biden. A guy who's been asked about this topic before, has been as clear and on the record about this topic as literally anything else in politics today. But will he stick to what he says? So Eddie Barkan put a tweet up with an amazing video, Joe Biden's own words. And I want you to take a look at this, and then hopefully this will be what's necessary to get Joe Biden to do what's right.
Dear President Biden, I want to remind you of a promise you made to me and to the American people.
If the US discovers a vaccine first, will you commit to sharing that technology with other countries? And will you ensure there are no patents to stand in the way of other countries and companies mass producing those life-saving vaccines?
Absolutely, positively. This is the only humane thing in the world to do.
Mr. President, you and I are both safe from this deadly pandemic because we could get the vaccine. And we will stay safe if you reverse Trump's inhumane policies and we vaccinate the entire world. That is the only way that we can prevent the development of vaccine-resistant coronavirus variants. But billions of families around the world aren't as lucky as you and me.
India's being engulfed by this virus, and its people are utterly helpless. Coming.
Mass cremations and funeral pyres now lighting.
India has set a global record for daily infections and
Indians
deaths.
Are being abandoned in the teeth of a deadly disease. Only around 2% of Indians are fully inoculated.
If any American leader of our lifetime has understood the value of a single life and the deep pain of loss, it is you. But you also know the beauty of salvation. You know the joys that life can bring. When I asked you last year if you would change the global rules for vaccines, you did not hesitate, equivocate, or mince your words.
The answer is yes. Yes, yes, yes. And it's not only a good thing to do, it's overwhelmingly in our interest to do it as well.
May 5th will be your moment, America's moment, to steer us down a more just and humane path. Governments from around the globe will gather at the World Trade Organization. They will ask America to waive the rules that are blocking them from making enough vaccines to protect their people. In this pandemic, millions of families around the world are grieving because of one stray cough, one brief mistake, one unfortunate moment. American innovation has delivered health and safety to the people of this country. But billions of people have been excluded. Their dreams are no less real than ours. Their love is no less strong, their lives are no less worthy. But because they live somewhere else, because they have less money, because the international laws are unfair, and because the pharmaceutical companies are so greedy, millions more people may die of this disease. You know that this is wrong. You know it in the marrow of your bones. In a few days, at the WTO meeting, all eyes will be on America. We will decide the answer to the world's plague. What kind of leadership will we display? The answer, Mr. President, is up to you.
Okay, that's destroying me. He's obviously right. It is so clear. Wozni, Biden has never been that clear on an issue before. Like, what more could he have said?
Nothing. That was powerfully done. He said unequivocally, this is what I want to do and why I want to do it, because it's humane and it's in the long term interests of our country to do so. Like that he tell you what he wants to do and why it's the smart thing to do so. And then even adds a little moralistic twist to it at the end. So it's like it's a three-pronged argument, John. A lot of times Biden is kind of vague, or he does like to publicly, specifically in his rhetoric, he likes to come off as incremental and moderate. He did not do that here. And so, man, I hope that commercial goes out everywhere and he has to feel the pressure of that. And it's like, I don't care what side of this sort of culture war or whatever we want to call Democratic and Republican voters, right? I don't care where you fall on that. How can you really give a damn about the patents of some pharmaceutical company?
Exactly.
It's like this. That's just not something any freaking normal person, working person, could give a damn about. So this is gonna be an obvious winner.
Yeah, you would think. Like, I hope that nobody does care. I don't know. Maybe like 40% of Republicans or something. But like, I don't even think like the the sentient manifestation of capitalism would expect you to care about that. They're like, yeah, no, I know we can get you to buy phones whenever we want or whatever, but like, you care about our patents? Really? That was too easy. But we'll see. We'll see. I honestly, at this point, don't know exactly where Joe Biden stands on this, right. But I want him to feel as much pressure as possible, specifically because, as we pointed out a couple of times this year, he is willing to change when there's pressure applied to him. Or if you want to conceptualize it a different way, dude backs down when you pressure him. That's good. We didn't have that for 4 years. Nobody was getting Trump to back down on literally anything. But with Biden, it's possible. So I would love to see that video. You can go on Twitter to AD's page and you can spread it there. Amazingly well done. And by the way, it's not just Biden. He's obviously the most important person here. But let's take a look at what Dr. Anthony Fauci said. Told the Times in an interview Monday that he, quote, always respects the needs of the companies to protect their interests, to keep them in business, but we can't do it completely at the expense of not allowing vaccine that's life-saving to get to the people that need it. You can't have people throughout the world dying because they don't have access to a product that rich people have access to. Everybody trusts Fauci. Biden, you wanna go against Fauci? Huh? Is that what you wanted to? People love that guy. And so hopefully they won't. Biden wants to be seen as like FDR 2.0. And in particular, he wants to be seen as like the most like just filled with empathy president that we've had in forever. Something, something, spirit of America. He's got his moonshot for cancer, which is a great idea. Super difficult. We don't know if we're gonna get it, but we can totally save millions of lives this way. That is fully within his reach. So we'll have to see if he's gonna take that opportunity. America, really weirdly, is one of the few countries with its level of resources around the world that doesn't offer paid leave. Biden is apparently planning on changing that. So we've got some details on one component of the American Families Plan. That is a $225 billion investment to provide 12 weeks of paid parental, family, and sick leave to virtually all American workers in the next 10 years. Now, up until right now, no US president has ever even introduced a plan to create a comprehensive paid leave program at the national level. I feel like it's worth pausing on that sentence. Like, they didn't do it under Obama. Trump, right-wing populist, didn't give a damn if the workers that supported him ever had a moment off. Nobody had done it. Like, for any of the, like, they list all these potential reasons. So, within 10 years, the plan would guarantee workers within 10, everything's within 10 years. Anyway, we guarantee workers 12 weeks of paid leave, which they could use to bond with a new child, care for a seriously ill loved one, deal with a loved one's military deployment, find safety from sexual assault, stalking, or domestic violence, heal from their own serious illness, or take time to deal with the death of a loved one. I love the acknowledgement from the White House there that real people, real workers suffer in a lot of different ways. So he wants to provide some time off. Wazzy, what do you think?
Yeah, everything you said at the top is 100% on the nose and on the money. A lot of this is sort of just being brought up to speed to countries like Sweden. You know what I mean? And so, you know, we don't want to be sort of snarky about this because yes, we're freaking late to the party. We should have been doing this for people. But two, man, like, people's lives are gonna be materially affected by this. Like, this is gonna change so much for so many people, give them the relief and the support that they need in, you know, their most vulnerable moments, you know, like when people are dealing with illnesses or deaths, et cetera, et cetera. This is huge, right? Like, again, you know, nobody wants to come up here and basically call the federal government under this administration the freaking tooth fairy. But look, man, like this is going to help so many people get through so much difficult times. And that's what the function of a federal government should be in the first place. Like, exactly. That's the whole reason to even have a federal government. So this is amazing news. And let's just be real. You talked about, you know, Obama didn't try to do this. I was talking to Nando the other day, and this administration is basically shaping it up to be the best one since Lyndon Johnson, which just took me out. I was just like, wow.
Yeah.
That's insane, man. And you know, you gotta tip your cap to Biden and the squad over there. They're doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, like what you said, I think is, I mean, we'll see, but I think it's probably true. Now, a case can be made that that has much more to say about past administrations than about this one, potentially.
Of course.
Definitely. And he's continued a number of different Trump policies. We don't need to go back over. We've done it a million times. His foreign policy is probably going to be a disaster. I'm going to be talking with Jeremy Scahill later on today about that. But that said, he is doing things that they didn't try to do under Obama. I can't wait, Wozni. I can't wait to find out what reason Joe Manchin has to be against this plan.
Oh, man.
I don't know, like there's some QAnon guy in Arizona that doesn't like it. I don't want to make him mad, so I'm not going to support it.
It's you know, and the funny thing is, with a lot of these social welfare sort of safety net policies, we know why they wanted to be smaller or against it. It's because our overlords often use these things as bargaining chips against us in their hiring practices. Like, look, I give you 6 weeks paid leave. Look what it, like now that they don't have those to offer, they have to offer us more of something else. And so that's why they don't like it. They want to be able to dangle this kind of stuff over our heads and explain to us why, you know, we're so lucky that you know, that our daddies, our overlords are providing us with basic human needs and resources, right? Like just the most basic of things, something like sick leave, like I'm really sick, or my mom is really sick and I'm her only caregiver. I need time off and I need to still be able to pay my mortgage. This is basic, or my rent, whatever the case may be. This is basic, but that's the only reason somebody, a corporatist like Joe Manchin, is against it. The only people that's against this stuff is capital. And the only reason they can be against it is because they're like, no, we like having that to as an axe to just chop people's heads off when they don't get in line, right? And so, you know, it's obvious what Joe Manchin's always gonna say.
Yeah, 100%. Like I love that you mentioned the paid sick leave specifically. So they're gonna do 7 days of sick leave specifically every year. Like how he's got a radical idea. 1 year after a devastating public health emergency, we're gonna help people have a little bit of time off if they get sick. you should probably have that actually. Yeah, there's a few lessons coming out of last year. It don't seem like they should be that difficult to learn. Turns out the unemployment system's a complete disaster. We should do something about that. Turns out that tying someone's health insurance to employment is really bad when a crisis can wipe out both of those things simultaneously. Anyway, yeah, totally. The one thing I would also take issue with is, it's the 10 years to implement it. Man, if I was him, I would be like, we're gonna get you 12 weeks of paid leave or whatever amount. And we're gonna do it in 7 years. And you know why we're gonna do it in 7 years? Because in my last year, I'm gonna have so worked my ass off for you that I'm gonna need time off. That's what I would say if I was Joe Biden. But instead, it's like 10 years. Okay, I get. And it's a spooling up. Obviously, we'll get some over that time. I get it, blah, blah, blah. Oh, and by the way, here's a fun chart. File this under America's number one. Let's take a look at weeks of maternity leave in a variety of countries around the world. Oh, look at Estonia. 80, honestly, that's a lot. Estonia, what's going on over there? Anyway, Hungary is like trying to catch up to Estonia. Coming in right behind Hungary is Lithuania. The Slovak Republic doing pretty well right there too. Latvia, Austria, Slovenia. Just point your finger at like a good portion of the map and you're gonna hit something that looks a little bit better than, oh, there we are at the bottom. The zero. Zero. Even Ireland. Ireland's barely trying and they make us look pathetic there. Don't give me that, Sophie. What is that? What is that? 6 weeks? Ireland. Come on, New Zealand. I've heard how you're a paradise. Look at Estonia. You're not looking so good. Anyway, we look so terrible. God, this myth that we have generated about how great we are, it relies on not traveling at all.
Yeah, and just the general like concept of we should be taking care of people is just like anathema to you know, mainstream American politics, where for years all we've been told is that, you know, people like you and I and Sophie should be lifting ourselves up by our own bootstraps. You know, that bootstrap stuff, that rhetoric is cooked. Everybody kind of realizes that it's nonsense, that if you fall on hard times, it's not because you're a lazy prick. You know, it's because it happens to everybody, you know, and we should be there and take care of people when those times arise. And so, yeah, man, it's cool. And again, the fact that they could be this aggressive, which it's not actually aggressive, but it seems aggressive when you consider the starting point. It just shows you that they know that the public sentiment is behind something like this. Yeah. 100%.
100%, yes. So we will see. We'll be tracking it. And as with all this legislation, let's find out Manchin and Sinema gonna have some saucy Instagram pic of her with like nice nails and saying you don't get any leave. Let's find out. Anyway, with that, let's turn to some good news. And for the few people in the audience who don't live in LA, you're gonna feel a little bit excluded, but deal with it. I wanna be happy for a moment. Okay. Very good news in LA County, where I am located. Wozni, you're off in a different part of LA County, but not too far. We've got some good news. Read online, for the second straight day, LA County is reporting zero coronavirus deaths. Last time that happened was March 2020, when the state first went into lockdown. I believe it's 410 days of deaths, but we've now hit no deaths. We had just 255 cases. Our county alone has had 1.23 million and just 255, zero deaths. We've had 24,000 deaths just in this county. 390 people are hospitalized. So that is going down as well. By the way, we recorded our first COVID death back on March 19th of last year when four people died. That was like a day or two after we went on lockdown here at TYT. And every day LA County has lost someone in the meantime. So Wozni, like, it could get bad again in theory. I'm gonna give some reasons to believe that isn't likely to happen, but what are your thoughts about LA's progress?
It's funny because I remember when the vaccine rollout started happening, and I remember this sort of idea that people needed to be sold on the vaccine and its efficacy, that people would need to be campaigned into getting vaccinated. And then when they started rolling it out to the public, everybody who was trying to get appointments couldn't get one. Yeah, which said to me that people wanted to be vaccinated. And as they've ratcheted up the amount of dosages that have been made available to people, people are taking advantage of it, getting vaccinated, and here's your result. Yep. Less deaths, less sickness, everybody's sort of moving on with their lives. Like, that's all that means to me, is that the vaccine rollout worked according to plan. And that, you know, this idea that there's this, you know, large swath of people who just refuse to be vaccinated or whatever, or anti-science, et cetera, I don't think that's the case. I think people want to be protected from this deadly virus. And I think people, you know, this is LA, people do want to get back to nightlife and restaurants and et cetera, et cetera. You know, maybe going to the Hollywood Bowl or whatever it is that you like to do. You know what I mean?
Have
so
you,
I think that's a big part of it.
Have you been to Cinespia?
I have not.
Oh, it's the best, man. It's a Hollywood Forever Cemetery. Everybody goes. They put a movie on the side of this big building. You bring food, you bring liquor, you bring some other things maybe. The best. Oh God, I can't wait to do that again.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. You know, the first time I went to Hollywood Bowl, I was just blown away by the fact that it was BYOB. I just thought that was such a great concept, that you could just, you know, bring a couple bottles of wine, listen to Solange and just get going. So yeah, that's what I think it is though, John. I think people want to get back to doing all the things that make living in this very expensive city worth it. And that's what you're seeing with the vaccination rollout. People are, hey man, they filled up Giant Stadium with people trying to be vaccinated. I mean, not Giant Stadium, excuse me, Dodger Stadium. Sorry, Dodgers fans, don't come at me.
That's the sort of sports mistake I make. You're the expert.
Yeah, and you know, and so that's all it is. I'm proud of the city for you know, for the people who were in charge, all of those workers who were in charge of getting this stuff through. They've been amazing. The work that they've done on the ground as far as both the testing people and the, you know, administering the vaccines. It's just been dope to watch. And honestly, if you leave out of your house in LA the last week or so, people are freaking back outside. Yeah. So yeah, this is dope to see.
Yeah, I will say this is the most anecdotal thing I've said in a long time, but I feel like I see more mask compliance than I did like 6 months ago. I feel like that last spike in LA did get more people to wear masks. And the thing is, we might not need it for that much longer, honestly, because people have been so responsible. They've really wanted it. Like, I remember tweet went around a couple weeks before I got vaccinated, and it was like, Cal State LA is opening up to anyone, just sign up. You don't even need an appointment, just show up. And they had to close it down because so many people wanted to get it. So just heads up to other parts of the country that, I don't know, like watch Tucker Carlson or whatever. Why do we have no deaths? Vaccine doesn't work, right? They've been lying to you. What's stopping all the deaths then? Anyway, let's see. Oh, also, by the way, California now has the lowest COVID rate of any state in the country after at one point being like the worst in the country. We had 290 deaths on January 8th. Damn. And now zero. So anyway, good job everyone. As Wes pointed out, the healthcare workers that made it possible and got us through those really dark times. Thank you so much for that. It's good to see the city starting to come back. Can't wait to see movies, go to places, go to the mall, all that stuff. We know that Fox has spent a lot of time recently pretending that they care about women's sports, pretending that their insane level of coverage about trans young athletes is anything other than fear-mongering, xenophobia, and demonization. But you might not have known how bad it's gotten if you don't watch Fox News religiously, as they do. Well, Media Matters has done an analysis of the number of segments about these topics that they've done. And I want you to take a look at this chart. This is madness. In March, they did 30 discussions, 30 separate discussions about high school trans athletes. Now, they've been talking about it off and on for the last couple of years, but they've done more in the past, like so far this year, than in the 2 years before it. And look, I'm not an expert on sports. So, Wazi, let me ask you a question. Have the last 4 months been really big for trans athletes taking over literally every sport? Is there some kind of crisis or emergency that has reasonably and rationally generated this level of coverage from Fox News?
No, of course not. It's not an emergency, just generally speaking. There isn't some scourge of trans athletes just shattering state title records and, you know, just grabbing up all of the scholarships, the college scholarships, athletic ones anyway. It's just, there's no data to back this, man. Like, it's like 9 people in a country of 350 million. Like, it's just the fake fear mongering. You know, again, as you know, John, they can't come out and effectively attack something like paid sick leave. They can't come out and attack Biden for that. They can't attack Biden for wanting to give people jobs in the infrastructure bill. They can't attack him for that. So they figure out, all right, we got to get him on this flank because the Dems don't say horrible things about trans people. So they must be extremists on every issue involving that group of citizens. It's obvious, it's pathetic. It kind of shows that like Biden's agenda just overall has a lot of popular appeal. His actual agenda. So the fact that they can't come out and attack them, because you know, we remember what happened when Barry first got up in there in 2009. We had a whole fake populist movement called the Tea Party. We had all kinds of, well, you know, it's just that his values don't align with us. You know, like there were so many ways that they could attack Barry. It's just obviously not effective with Joe Biden. And all of his freaking policies have very wide popular appeal. So they are stuck between a hard
even among Republicans. Yeah.
Even amongst Republicans.
Totally, yeah.
No, they can chase their tail with this crap.
Yeah, and do quite a bit of damage to people who are struggling with a very difficult part of their life at that age in a lot of these states around the country while doing so. Yeah, Fox, like Biden's a crazy commie Chinese radical, right? You should be like loving this. You should be striking down all of his socialist propaganda and his socialist plans. Why don't you want to talk about that? Why are you talking about sentient potatoes and kids books you haven't read and trans athletes, it turns out as well. So let's dive into a few more of these numbers because Media Matters did a great job on this. Here is one of the most amazing things. So 126 different separate discussions about trans athletes over the last 2 years. 72 just this year. Across all of that, they named 9 particular trans women athletes, one of whom's not allowed to compete, none of whom dominate their field. Their argument from the very beginning has been women's sports, which we care so much about, just doesn't work anymore because these trans athletes have destroyed it, and so we need to ban them. They have not cited one single instance of that. I would argue that even if they were capable of doing that, that doesn't justify anything like a ban at all, obviously. But they haven't even tried. They just talk about it. 126 discussions. They've also cited it randomly during other discussions 58 times, just randomly bringing it up. I often tell people the little anecdote of one of the times that I was on Larry King, and there was a conservative from the Daily Wire on, and we were sitting in the green room, and there was like a moment of silence. And then he just randomly brought up his issues with the trans community. It was the weirdest thing. It would be like if I just randomly talked about like my last game of D&D. It's like, who do you think I am that you think that's what I want to hear you talk about? But anyway, yeah, they just randomly talk about it. They just attack him. Tucker Carlson did 27 discussions on his show alone. Tucker Carlson, the very reasonable guy that leftists can totally work with, did 27 different xenophobic, hate mongering, anti-trans segments in just the last couple of years. Have I done 27 segments on literally anything other than maybe COVID? Pop-Tarts, arguably, but I have a personal problem. That's really about me, not about the Pop-Tarts. It's just crazy, Wozni. And he's huge, huge audience for this sort of baseless fear mongering.
Yeah, and you know, the dumbest part about all of this is this idea that they're trying to peddle that dudes are like, you know, they're like making themselves into trans people just so they could kill girls at sports, which ignores the reality of trans people's lives. Okay, like these people get attacked and abused at a higher rate than the rest of the population. Suicide rates are higher because of the treatment that they get amongst society as basically second-class citizens who aren't worthy of love and dignity. Why would somebody sign up for that voluntarily? who's lining up to do that? To get a couple of high school trophies? It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And again, it goes against what we should be doing, which is like trying to make these folks' lives more aligned with everybody else in the country, right? That they're allowed to have some level of dignity and respect. You know, that's what we should be trying to do. Instead, we're demonizing these people with some made up horrible idea that just to get, you know, a couple of fake medals during high school or even college athletics, if we're being honest, this idea that that level of glory is worth all the stuff that comes with being a trans person is just stupid.
Yep. And so Media Matters is focusing here obviously on Fox's coverage of it, but Fox's coverage of it has an effect. So many state legislatures have already passed legislation just this year about this. They did that because it was talked about on Fox News. And if they actually tried to support it, and if it was actually true that these athletes were dominating it, again, that doesn't actually prove that their solutions are moral or just in any way. But they're not even trying to do that. Ignoring that, like, people don't just do high school sports, as Waz is saying, to win trophies. They're growing up. They're trying to find acceptance. They're trying to figure out who they are. But I'm making the mistake of treating them as people. So they're obviously not going to understand that. But anyway, I just want to make sure that the audience knows that, like, how can you talk about it this many times never acknowledging like the people that are supposedly doing these things you consider so bad, not having on, like how many of those conversations had a single trans person in them? How many trans people does Tucker Carlson know? Like it's, I just hate it. I hate that it's so influential that they've made so much money off of doing it. Anyway, we have unfortunately reached the end of our show. Wozni, as always, thank you so much for joining us. So as we talked about at the beginning of the show, you've got some new endeavors. So where can people go and when can they go there to see your writing, to see you on podcasts and all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be writing for TheRinger.com. Really excited about some of the things that I'll be working on with the homies over there. So you can read me at The Ringer now. Of course, shouts to everybody at The Athletic. Two amazing years over there. Worked with some of the most talented people in the business. So shouts to everybody over there still at The Athletic. Love you guys. But yeah, you can read me at The Ringer now. And I will be populating several of their podcasts because they are one of the titans in the podcast game as far as the studio is concerned. So I'm really excited about just being able to bring whatever it is that I have to offer to, you know, a world and an infrastructure that they built to be so damn amazing. So I'm excited for the opportunity. I can't wait to hit the ground running. But of course, tonight, we're doing our work with TYT, Wozni on the TYT Twitch stream. We're going to have a lot of fun. That's going to be the point of it. And it's going to be Wednesday nights too. Tuesday and Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. We're going to go crazy.
Awesome. Sounds like fun. Thank you again. Have a good day, man.
Later, y'all.
Joe Biden has been a figure in American politics for longer than virtually anyone else. He has been trying to become president for virtually as long as I've been alive. And so there's a lot that we know about him, but there's also a massive history there. And so as we look to the next few years of his administration, trying to get an idea of what he's going to do in domestic policy and foreign policy, questions of things like the budget, militarism, what should we know? What do we need to know to understand who he is and how he's changed over time? Well, we're very lucky to be joined by the senior correspondent and editor at large for The Intercept. For the first time on the show, Jeremy Scahill, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, John. Thanks.
Great to have you here. You have now released this massive look into who Joe Biden is, what he's said and done on all these different issues. Can you tell us about the focus, how it got started?
Yeah, well, you know, Joe Biden has been in political office for all but four of the last 49 years. And of course, the bulk of that has been as a United States Senator. He had his two terms as vice president. And I think that all of us sort of had a sense that we knew a lot about Joe Biden just because he's been around for so long. And not to be the master of the obvious, but we all knew that Joe Biden was inclined to support American war making. He famously voted for not just the Afghanistan war and the Patriot Act, but also the Iraq war, was very hawkish in the 90s. But I sort of figured like, you know, if this guy's gonna be president, it's worth actually probing him and his history in a way that rises to the level of the position that he's in. And so even though I felt like I knew a lot about Joe Biden, by going through sort of year by year and looking at his evolution as a senator, we learn an incredible amount, not just about Joe Biden, but about how all of the problems that Joe Biden is now claiming he wants to fix were created in the first place. And what we found is that Joe Biden has been a part of really messing the country up in a lot of ways on both foreign and domestic policy levels as a senator. But I also was surprised to learn that Joe Biden was actually really good on a lot of issues at various times in his career, and then would turn around and sort of undo all of the good that he did. And that was one of the more striking aspects of this history.
Yeah, you know, there's this popular perception that like whether you agree with him politically, he's trying to be a good guy, you know, like he doesn't seem as like driven by personal animosity towards different groups and all that. But you point out in your work that very often the things that he speaks out against from a values point of view are the very things that the policies and the positions he supports could end up increasing the amount of in the world.
So yeah, I mean, let's go back and look at, I mean, look at, you know, in 1972, Joe Biden is running for Senate for the first time. What was happening in 1972? Well, you had this incredible growth of the civil rights movement. You had an anti-war militancy taking hold as the Vietnam War dragged on and on. And Joe Biden, you know, was against the Vietnam War, but he was very explicit that he wasn't against it for any moral reasons or because, you know, upwards of 2 million Vietnamese had been slaughtered and, you know, 60,000 American troops. Joe Biden thought that it was sort of a fool's errand and that it wasn't waged in a smart way. And in fact, Biden tells this story in one of his memoirs on how he was walking through his campus in law school and saw anti-war students and chuckled with a group of friends calling them assholes. So, you know, he comes into the Senate being on the right side of history in a very kind of technical sense in being opposed to the Vietnam War, but why he was opposed to it was very telling. Biden enters the Senate and by chance ends up working on one of the most consequential laws that would be passed covering US wars, the War Powers Act of 1973. And throughout his career, Joe Biden has been one of the most dedicated political figures in the United States, trying to rein in on a policy level the excesses of the executive branch. You know, he comes into office at the dying days of the Nixon administration and sees the lawless CIA and executive branch out of control. So Biden talks a really good game about implementing war powers protections and knowing that Congress has the right to declare war. But then, starting with Ronald Reagan, you see Joe Biden start to realize what it means to be a powerful and influential senator. And he starts to back away from some of the policies and even the legislation he co-sponsored when he starts to get a taste for what it means to be able to authorize war as a member of the Senate or to influence policy.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to resist the urge to jump to the present and start to analyze his current presidency based on the lens that you're showing, but I want to stay in some of this past. So, you know, the 80s, obviously, the Democratic Party has to contend with Ronald Reagan, the beginning of that movement, some shifting in the makeup of the Republican base and all of that. And there was quite a bit of military adventurism and all that. So what are some of the particular stances he's taken that you think could inform how he might govern as president now?
You know, many Democrats were militantly opposed to the Reagan administration's funding and arming of the Contra death squads in Nicaragua and were against the backing of the military dictatorship in El Salvador. But at the same time, it was mainstream Democratic Party thinking to view the world through the lens of the Cold War. And so you saw Biden, on the one hand, speaking in very clear terms about the death squads in Nicaragua and the dictatorship in El Salvador. But at the same time, Biden starts to sort of try to cut deals with the Reagan White House, wherein Biden says, look, I don't think we should cut and run in El Salvador. Let's link some of our funding for the dictatorship there to investigations of the murder of American nuns, the rape and murder of American nuns in El Salvador. Now, I give Biden credit for, you know, trying to confront the fact that so many Catholic clergy, including Americans, were being murdered in El Salvador. But what it really boiled down to was Biden was saying, I want to be able to support Reagan's wars. I just want to put some conditions on it. In Nicaragua, he says, well, you know, I don't really like the Contra death squads, but I'm open to supporting them if we can sort of put a list together of the things they're allowed to spend our money on. And one of the things I say in the project is that, you know, you don't really negotiate with death squads, you know? And so I think what you see is that Biden, as he talks now about wanting to cut deals with the Republicans, and he's in a very tough position given the state of the Senate, has shown a willingness to kick under the bus moral considerations, considerations about civilians being killed as a result of American policy in favor of what he believes is a sort of greater national good to support a president, whether they're a Democrat or a Republican, or to implement geostrategic policies that he thinks are going to increase the influence of America across the world. And that was most pronounced in the 80s and 90s with the expansion eastward of NATO. But I think if you want to sort of summarize it, Biden is an empire politician in the, and I would say that if we didn't have Donald Trump, it would be less controversial to call Joe Biden an American nationalist. But I think that Biden really is a guy who believes in America as the shining city on the hill. And that form of American exceptionalism can be very lethal to other people around the world. So, you know, Biden has this horribly tragic history. I really learned a lot about Biden's family life too. I mean, this guy has been to hell and back. It's real. Like, this is not some fiction of politics. Joe Biden gets elected to the Senate. His wife is killed and his daughter in a car crash. Biden has to alternate between being a widower, a senator, and a father to his children. And there were real questions about whether he would even be able to serve in the Senate. And what's interesting is that the Biden that emerges from those crises is a guy who gets a reputation as being the best friend you could have in life. He's beloved by his family. At the same time, you know, he is getting involved with the militarization of American foreign policy. He's starting to work on a covert level with the CIA in its war against whistleblowers. And I think that if Biden is your friend and on your side, he's probably a great guy to have in your corner. But if you're not someone whose life Biden considers to be important, he's gonna place what he considers to be America's prestige or interests above your very livelihood. And I think that's true for a lot of politicians. But Biden has 50 years worth of policy to track it and prove why it's true.
Any quick ideas on how we can get Joe Manchin and Kristi Sinema added to that list? Or no, I'm kidding. Anyway,
I think that, you know, Bernie Sanders would have had a very difficult time even making the case to either of those two wackadoodles. And I think if anyone could sort of pull them over, it's Joe Biden. Look, John, this is the wild card with the Biden presidency. Biden is, for in a lot of ways, a right-wing hawkish Democrat with the track record to prove it. On the other hand, he was elected because of the times in which we live, because of the horrors of the Trump era, because a lot of leftists held their nose and voted for him. So the sort of push and pull of this era is going to be, is the Joe Biden of the past 50 years going to be in charge, or is Biden going to make concessions to the people that put him there? You know, this is always the conversation we have, but it does seem like Biden at some level recognizes the times in which we live. And I think on a domestic level, he's shown some backbone in a way that the Democrats have not been showing in recent years. I don't mean to go too far in praising him. I'm just saying we live in a complicated moment. And I think Biden, more than anyone who served in that office, understands how quickly it goes away. And I think he is gonna try to swing big on some things. I'm very concerned though about where American foreign policy goes, particularly if there's a terror attack or a new conflict that breaks out. Biden hasn't yet explained what his policy is on drone strikes. They're still reviewing it. Biden is already starting to walk back some of his statements about Afghanistan. He's gonna have strike teams in the region. He's saying we reserve the right to go back in. So we're 100 days in. And I think that, you know, we haven't even gotten yet to the chapter about foreign policy with Biden, and the jury is out on which Joe Biden's gonna show up.
Sure. Yeah, we haven't had one of those sort of critical moments like we had in a few cases with Trump, and we've really got to see what they thought about some of these things. So that's definitely something we're gonna be watching for. So I wanna move, as much as I would love to go through the 90s and especially the response to 9/11, war in Afghanistan, Iraq, and all that, I wanna try to apply some of this. So based on your research, you've mentioned there some potential concerns about the statements about pulling fully out of Afghanistan after 2+ decades. Some other potential issues. So we know that the WTO is gonna be talking about what's gonna happen with vaccines. Joe Biden has been very clear that he supports, you know, getting rid of those patent protections and all of that in the past. That's one of those big moral things that he supposedly stands for, but as you point out, he sometimes is willing to set those aside. He's modified our relationship in some ways with Saudi Arabia vis-a-vis Yemen, but is being very silent about the blockade, and we don't know exactly where that relationship is gonna go. So there's a lot of topics, feel free to take it wherever you want, but based on your research, what has your opinion of his foreign policy and how you expect him to act changed in any significant ways?
Well, I mean, one thing that greatly concerns me, and this doesn't just apply to Biden, it's just the times in which we live. I see this pattern where there is a demand that our leaders become really openly belligerent and hostile to other major powers in the world. I think China policy is gonna be an area where there's gonna be a bipartisan push for Joe Biden to sort of militarize his rhetoric on China. It sort of slipped under the radar, but there's been a kind of rejiggering of how US Navy SEALs and some other special operations forces are gonna be transforming their role in the world away from counterterrorism missions and more toward maritime operations and dealing with big nation state threats. And I think that there's gonna be a temptation to go all in ratcheting up the rhetoric on both China and Russia. Biden definitely is a big NATO hawk. He has been aggressively supporting the eastward expansion of NATO. On the other hand, Biden really has a long history of being concerned about excessive use of executive authority. Now that he's the commander in chief, it's gonna be very interesting to see if he defers to congressional authorities on war powers. The temptation is so great for a commander in chief to say, no, I know what is in America's national security interest. Joe Biden is a very old man, he's at the end of his career. If he were to just flush down the toilet 50 years of work on trying to confront executive power abuses and war powers, it would mean that it was decades spent on a mission that he just decided at the end wasn't worth it. So I'm gonna be really curious to see how Biden takes it in terms of both China and Russia. Also Iran, Biden was a key player, as was Tony Blinken, his Secretary of State, in securing the Iran nuclear deal that Trump abandoned and crushed into a million little pieces. It's gonna be very interesting to see if Biden and Blinken try to add more conditions on the Iranians or are willing to go back and say, let's reset this to where we were and move forward, which ultimately I think is crucial to how we end the slaughter and the genocide in Yemen. It's a two-pronged approach. You have to stop the Saudis, who for a long time were doing this entirely with the support of the United States, and only recently that started to shift. But also Iran has been drawn deeper into Yemen because of Saudi Arabia and because of US policy. So if Biden wants to really think big on this, he could make a negotiation with Iran also include aspects of our Yemen policy, particularly if Biden does actually cut Saudi Arabia off. It's a tough battle that that Congress is gonna be waging on this. And it's all about human rights activists and anti-war activists who have forced this issue. But if Biden cuts off the Saudis and shows a willingness to negotiate with Iran, I think we could see some really positive aspects to his presidency.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. One more quick question, just because I'm having fun. So you have Biden as a figure, then you also have the political context. And the Senate recently, over the past few years under Trump, showed a willingness to re-engage with the War Powers Act and try to exert themselves in some of the conflicts that we're talking about, actually. Just your sort of political gut, do you think that that's going to continue when we get to that crisis moment? If Biden does show a willingness to sort of go it alone in terms of the executive, if he is incredibly militaristic, do you think that this new quasi bipartisan anti-war effort with people like Ro Khanna and Bernie Sanders and a few others is likely to continue to check him the way they were with Donald Trump?
I think to a degree it already is checking him. I mean, if you look at the ultra hawkish wing of the Democratic Party, Hillary Clinton joined with Condoleezza Rice to basically say, no, we shouldn't withdraw from Afghanistan. And I actually want to give Biden a lot of credit for one thing in particular about this Afghanistan announcement that he made. This was the plan that was on his desk when Donald Trump left office. Donald Trump, for all of his heinous crimes, had a couple of good instincts about American war making around the world. Even if you and I don't agree with how he got to that point, Trump truly seemed to want to get out of Afghanistan. And the Pentagon and the CIA, I really believe, were trying to wait Trump out, believing that Joe Biden would reverse course and say, no, this is a precipitous withdrawal of troops. I give Biden credit for saying, no, I actually am going to stick with this plan, even if I don't like some of the particulars of it. So it could actually be that what we're seeing is the anti-war crowd basically winning the argument and getting Biden on side with this. and that you see more hawkish Democrats try to block some aspects of ratcheting down the American wars abroad by joining with the Republicans to do it. And that's why it was so significant that you had Hillary Clinton and Condoleezza Rice coming out and making Joe Biden look like some peacenik. I mean, let's remember Joe Biden, you know, in the late 70s voted to open the spigot of US support for Pakistan to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. What the war he's ending, he played his key role in starting well before 9/11. So I already would say that the fact that Biden stuck to this plan is a victory for the anti-war movement, with the caveat that we don't know what's going to happen with the contractors, and Biden is reserving the right to continue to strike in Afghanistan. But let's take the victories where we get them. Biden could have said, this was Trump's policy. It's insane. I'm walking away from it. And he would have been applauded by a lot of Democrats. Totally. He didn't do that. So let's not underestimate how big of a deal it is that Biden is actually saying, I'm going to pull the troops out. It's a significant moment.
Yeah, agreed. And we'll certainly continue to watch. We have only had time to scratch the surface, almost literally. So if you're interested, Empire Politician is available at The Intercept. I know it's coming in multiple forms. Jeremy Scahill, thank you so much for joining us. Really enjoyed the conversation, and it is incredibly important going forward.
Thanks, John. Keep up the good work.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.